UTC, right here on VOA.
I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Moscow is warning the U.S. over letting Ukraine strike Russian soil with longer-range weapons, AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
American officials say President Biden's shifting policy and easing limits on what Ukraine can hit with U.S.-provided systems. He'd ruled out the move for months over fears it would lead to a direct confrontation between Russia and NATO. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov says the decision adds fuel to the fire. Deputy White House National Security Advisor John Finer says Moscow itself is to blame.
The fire was lit by Russia's invasion.
Finer's not confirming the shift, which comes after North Korean forces arrived in Russia and are apparently deploying to help push Ukrainian troops out of a border region. UK security expert Patrick Beery figures that helped drive the shift, but
I think it's too late to have a major strategic effect.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The U.S. on Monday imposed sanctions on organizations and firms involved in illegal settlement development in the occupied West Bank, including a well-established, decades-old group that has close ties with Israeli leadership. The U.S. Treasury Department sanctioned Amana, the largest organization involved in illegal settlement development in the West Bank, and its subsidiary. Amana is already sanctioned by Britain and Canada, and it is one of the major funders and supporters of unauthorized settlements in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Settlement tracking group Peace Now says its assets are valued at around 600 million Israeli shekels, or about $160 million, and that it has a yearly budget stretching into tens of millions of shekels. This is VOA News. Brazil is pushing for concerted action to alleviate hunger as it hosts a summit of the group of 20 leading economies amid global uncertainty over two major wars and incoming U.S. President-elect Donald Trump. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva welcomed foreign leaders to Rio de Janeiro's Modern Art Museum Monday and delivered an opening address that focused on fighting food insecurity, heightened global tensions, and uncertainty about an incoming Trump administration had already tempered expectations for a strongly worded statement addressing the conflicts in the Middle East and between Russia and Ukraine. A search and rescue effort is ongoing in Tanzania's commercial capital after a building collapse on Saturday killed at least 13 people. That's according to authorities who say dozens of others have been rescued so far. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
Crews search tirelessly for survivors still trapped in the rubble of a collapsed building in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. More than a dozen people were killed and more than 80 were rescued, according to the country's president, after a four-story building in the city's Kariakou market collapsed on Saturday morning. Prime Minister Kassim Majaliwa on Monday told reporters rescuers remain determined.
This operation will not stop. It will go on until we can confirm that all the business people who were here have been rescued. We will be grateful to God if we manage to bring them all out alive.
Tapping sounds were heard on Sunday from within the rubble of the building, according to the BBC. Building collapses are not uncommon in many African cities where weak construction standards and lax enforcement persist.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. Russia vetoed a UN resolution on Monday calling for an immediate ceasefire in the war between Sudan's military and paramilitary forces and delivery of humanitarian aid to millions in desperate need. Russia's ally China supported the resolution sponsored by Britain and Sierra Leone, along with all other UN Security Council members. Russia told the council it vetoed the resolution because it should be solely the government of Sudan that should be responsible for what happens in the country. Sudan plunged into conflict in April 2023 when long simmering tensions between its military and paramilitary leaders erupted in the capital, Khartoum, and spread to other regions, including western Darfur, which was racked by bloodshed and atrocities in 2003. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
react to a change in U.S. policy on weapons.
Maxim, another Kyiv resident, is more skeptical. He is waiting for the proof of what was announced in words to see the actual missiles flying deep into Russia.
President Joe Biden visits the Amazon.
The fight to protect our planet is literally a fight for humanity, for generations to come.
And President-elect Donald Trump says he'll use the U.S. military to carry out mass deportations of illegal migrants.
Even if you do not have documentation in the United States, you are protected by the Constitution.
Today is Tuesday, November 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Steve Karish. On Monday's program, we brought you the news that U.S. President Joe Biden has changed course and will allow Ukraine to use weapons supplied by America to fire on targets inside Russia. Not surprisingly, Ukrainians are feeling pretty good about that decision, but there's been a wide range of emotions in Kyiv as Russia launched one of the biggest strikes on Ukrainian energy infrastructure and on residential areas in Sumy and Odessa. For VOA, Anna Chernikova reports from Kyiv.
On Sunday, Ukraine went through a roller coaster of emotions. First was one of the largest Russian attacks on its energy infrastructure, and then a deadly ballistic missile attack on a residential building in Sumy. This was all followed by the news on President Joe Biden's decision to remove the restriction on the usage of the U.S. weapons to hit deep into the Russian territory. This was a long-awaited decision for Ukraine, as the country is soon to mark 1,000 days of Russian full-scale invasion. Reportedly, the UK and France may soon join the US and also leave the restriction for the Ukrainian armed forces to use their weapons too. Also, German Defense Minister Boris Pistorius confirmed Germany's intention to provide 4,000 innovative drones that use artificial intelligence to hit targets at a considerable distance. While there are no official comments on this news from Ukraine's international allies, President Volodymyr Zelensky hinted it is true in his Sunday evening address to the nation. Ukrainians perceived the news as positive. Many believe this could be a game-changer in the long term and a message to Russia that Ukrainian allies stand strong with Ukraine by all means. However, some think this decision came too late. Olga, a Kyiv citizen, believes this is good and thinks this decision will help Ukraine in the future. She added, however, that she doesn't think that the war with Russia will be solved by weapons alone, and that this long-awaited permission comes a little too late. Maxim, another Kyiv resident, is more skeptical. He is waiting for the proof of what was announced in words to see the actual missiles flying deep into Russia. When this happens, this would mean that the permission is real. All this on the same day that Ukraine survived one of the largest missile and drone attacks on its energy system, and a deadly attack on the resident building in Sumy. Overall, Ukrainian air defense forces shut down over 140 missiles and drones. The Minister of Energy of Ukraine, Herman Halushenko, confirmed that electricity generation and transmission facilities throughout Ukraine were the main target of the attack. As of Monday, Ukraine is back to the scheduled electricity outages throughout the country to ensure equal distribution of the energy. By the end of the day Sunday, Russian forces conducted another attack on the city of Sumy, this time with ballistic missiles. One of the missiles hit a residential neighborhood, killing at least 11 people, including 2 children, and injuring at least 89, including 6 children. On Monday, a similar attack happened in Odessa. At the moment, at least 10 people were confirmed killed, including 7 policemen, a doctor, and 2 local residents. The rescue operation is ongoing. Odessa residents are devastated. Oleksandr told journalists his apartment was heavily damaged and he and his family are alive due to the fact that they were not home at the moment of the attack. Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky visited frontline cities of Pokrovsk in the Donetsk region and Kupiansk in the Kharkiv region. Zelensky said he had a chance to talk to the Ukrainian soldiers who are defending the country in the most difficult parts of the front line and awarded them with state awards. He thanked everyone for their service. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
A little more on the situation in Ukraine. The Baltic states have committed to continue providing financial and material support to Kyiv. Part of that support is coming from the Latvian-led drone coalition. Vadislav Andrievs has that story narrated for us by Anna Rice.
Businessman Ivan Talchinsky is from Ukraine, but he lives in Latvia, where he runs Atlas, a Latvian drone-producing company.
What we're manufacturing is a 250-gram drone with two cameras, one 8K daytime camera and the other an infrared camera. Our main clients are now Germany, Holland, England. They plan a large enough procurement.
This small facility in the Latvian capital of Riga works primarily with NATO countries. But Talchinsky says his company has also sent over 1,000 drones to Ukraine.
Finally, everyone understands drones are important and have become a widely used weapon.
Elina Egle, the Federation of Security and Defense Industries of Latvia board chairwoman, has recently returned from a U.S. military exhibition and says drones are what everyone is talking about. She says the war in Ukraine is also a valuable teaching tool for military drone manufacturers.
By maintaining daily contact with the Ukrainian military units, we get invaluable information. We understand what the latest technologies need to be and how to better utilize them, as well as train the military to work with them.
Latvia proposed the Drone Coalition Initiative, which it coordinates along with the UK. The coalition, formally established in February, aims to supply the Ukrainian army with drones. 12 member states, including Germany and Canada, put forward an ambitious plan for drone production.
Each country is proud of its industry and wants to develop it, but only together can we create a critical mass. The coalition has publicly stated it wants to produce 1 million drones for Ukraine.
Talchinsky is providing some of those drones. His company has been making reconnaissance drones, but soon plans to move on to combat versions.
Today, FPV drones are very popular. They are used to attack the enemy's equipment, their forces, everything. They cost as much as mortars, but are much more precise.
Ukrainian drone operators are also testing Latvian-made drones. Engineers here say the Ukrainians are important to the process because they know exactly how the drones need to perform on the battlefield. Yuri Sushatskis is a representative for the Latvian Ministry of Defense.
Drones that are good today may be useless tomorrow because the enemy knows how to fight them already. So our manufacturers monitor the latest developments, and every new procurement is different from the last one.
In 2025, Latvia plans to allocate some $21 million to buy drones for Ukraine and train Ukrainian military operators. For Vladislav Sandrievs in Riga, Latvia, NRIs, VOA News.
Meanwhile, Joe Biden began a historic trip to Brazil on Sunday, becoming the first sitting American president to visit the Amazon rainforest. And he attended the G20 summit on Monday in Rio de Janeiro, where climate, poverty reduction, and other global causes were discussed. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara is traveling with the president and has this report from Rio.
Deforestation, shore erosion, and fire damage to the world's largest rainforest are some of the scenes that U.S. President Joe Biden saw Sunday. He is the first sitting American president to visit the Amazon. In Manaus, capital of the state of Amazonas, Biden announced that under his administration, the United States surpassed the goal of providing $11 billion per year in international climate financing in 2024, a key component in the fight against climate change lobbied by countries of the global south.
The fight to protect our planet is literally a fight for humanity, for generations to come. It may be the only existential threat to all our nations. and all humanity.
Biden met with indigenous leaders and announced U.S. investment in several climate initiatives, including $50 million for the Amazon Fund. From Manaus, Biden heads to the summit of the 20 largest economies, the G20, in Rio de Janeiro, where diplomatic sources told VOA they worry U.S. climate change efforts will be dramatically scaled back under Donald Trump's incoming administration. During his first term, Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord, the world's main multilateral forum to mitigate climate change. Biden said he is leaving Trump and the country a strong foundation to build on if they choose to do so. Biden couched his climate legacy in economic terms, the race between countries in harnessing the clean energy revolution.
It's true. Some may seek to deny or delay the clean energy revolution that's underway in America. But nobody can reverse it.
Trump is reportedly planning to roll back current tax credits for electric vehicle purchases, part of Biden's signature legislation on clean energy and climate change. Trump has repeatedly called climate change a hoax. However, the Brazilian president's chief advisor said he will not prejudge the Trump administration. Celso Amorim, chief advisor to Brazil's president.
I judge actions, so we'll see later how these actions evolve, and then we'll speak. For now, Biden has been a good partner for Brazil, for President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
At the G20 beginning Monday in Rio, Biden will focus on workers' rights and clean economic growth and attend the launch of the Global Alliance Against Hunger and Poverty. These are also initiatives that many diplomats here worry will not receive U.S. support under Trump, who slashed foreign aid funding while he was in office. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Rio de Janeiro.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. An Israeli airstrike slammed into a densely populated residential area in Lebanon's capital near key government and diplomatic buildings late Monday, killing at least five people. This as the U.S. pressed ahead with ceasefire negotiations. Lebanon's state-run news agency said two missiles hit the neighborhood where local U.N. headquarters and Lebanon's parliament and prime minister's office are located. Ecuador's government declared a 60-day national emergency due to raging forest fires made worse by severe drought conditions. The country's risk management secretariat announced on Monday Ecuador faces 17 active wildfires, as well as another five that have been controlled. Voters in Gabon overwhelmingly approved a new constitution, authorities said on Sunday, more than 1 year after mutinous soldiers overthrew the country's longtime president and seized power in the oil-rich country. Over 91% of voters approved the new constitution in a referendum held Saturday. The draft constitution proposes sweeping changes that could prevent dynastic rule. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Turning our attention to American politics and the presidential transition, Donald Trump will come to office in January with unified control of the U.S. Congress, as Republicans will hold majorities in both the Senate and the House. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
The new leader of the incoming Republican majority U.S. Senate. John Thune is the incoming Senate Majority Leader.
We have a mandate from the American people. A mandate not only to clean up the mess left by the Biden-Harris-Schumer agenda, but also to deliver on President Trump's priorities.
Thune takes the top leadership role in the Senate after Mitch McConnell served in that position for 18 years. And he is already facing his first test. President-elect Donald Trump has proposed bypassing the Senate's constitutional role of approving cabinet nominees. Senator John Thune.
The Senate has an advise and consent role in the Constitution, so we will do everything we can to process his noms quickly, get them installed in their position so they can begin to implement this agenda.
Democrats lost their majority and will hold at least 47 seats in the new Senate. Chuck Schumer is the current majority leader in the U.S. Senate.
The American people have presented us with a challenge. We must learn from it.
Trump had unified control of government during the first 2 years of his first term. But one analyst says that does not always mean the White House will get what it wants on Capitol Hill. Casey Burgat is Legislative Affairs Program Director at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
Mitch McConnell had said then that he supports the president's agenda. He'll work with them. But then we saw from nominations to policies that they will provide no votes if they think the president has gone too far.
Republicans also secured a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, earning praise from Trump.
It's nice to win.
The president-elect endorsed Speaker of the House Mike Johnson to lead again.
I believe it will be the most consequential Congress in the modern era, most consequential administration in the modern era, because, frankly, we have to fix almost every area of public policy.
But Republicans hold a much narrower majority in the House, with only a handful more seats than Democrats, who vowed to keep fighting. Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal.
The Congressional Progressive Caucus will continue to be ferocious defenders of the working class and poor people.
The new 119th U.S. Congress will be sworn into office on January 3rd.
Katherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
One of Trump's most controversial campaign promises was the mass deportations of undocumented migrants. Illegal migration and border security continue to be divisive issues in the U.S. even after the election. And early Monday, Trump re-entered the conversation, saying that he will follow through with his campaign promise. While his exact plans are unclear, he seemed to confirm on social media that he would declare a national emergency. That would grant him the authority to use the military and to bypass regular congressional approval. However, even that is up for debate. For more, I spoke with VOA's immigration reporter, Eileen Ibarros.
So the American Immigration Council actually said that under U.S. law, presidents can declare a national emergency and they can use emergency powers, but only in specific situations. It would be unprecedented to see the military doing that kind of operation. So I absolutely, based on the experts that I talked to, They will definitely push back. There will be pushbacks, and nonprofits and other organizations will try to sue and go to the courts.
So I think the pushback is to be expected. But leaving that aside for the moment, who is Trump targeting? We've heard some talk about only deporting criminals or only deporting people who are in the country illegally, which is millions of people. Do we know what his plans are? Who is he going to be looking for first?
He hasn't given specifics, but we do know that there is an estimated 11 million to 13 million documented people living in the United States. And to answer your question, we don't know. It can be that he can get some immigration officials outside of the courts. He can have ICE doing stopping at factories and see who's working there without documentation. There are situations that ICE can work and can do this kind of operation. But it also talks about the kind of manpower that United States have. And, you know, think about ICE officials, how many ICE officials the United States has right now to do this kind of job, to do this kind of operation, and deport about 11 million people. Even Tom Homan said that the man who Trump has called the border czar that wants to join him to join the administration as the border czar has said, I believe to CBS News, that they might have to rehire people, they might have to hire some more officers. So it's going to be interesting how they're going to pull that off. And again, going back to experts from the American Immigration Council, they said it would also be very costly, right? About $967 billion over a decade to get something like that done. I'm not saying that there won't be deportations, but we have to see how his administration will be able to pull this off.
Is it legal for a president to use the military inside the United States like this?
Based on what experts say, again, goes back to those very specific situations. It would be it would be complicated to answer that right now, because he will go to the courts if he tries to do this. So we have to wait and see.
Okay, so it's complicated legally. Clearly, operationally, it's massively complicated. Is there any sense from the administration that there is a plan in place for making this happen?
We haven't heard anything about any specific plans, but you also have to take into consideration that even if you do not have documentation in the United States, you are protected by the Constitution. So it's not like an ICE official can come and pick up someone and send them back and deport them right away to their country. There, even for that, there is a process. That person, even if that person is a criminal, has committed a crime or is a suspect of committed a crime, they have the right to go in front of a judge. So, again, there's a lot of legal aspects. There's no specific plans. They say that there is one, but it's going to be interesting when he is inaugurated and what is specifically they're going to share with everyone. And then I am expecting, going back to the nonprofits and immigration advocates, I expect them to be ready to fight right in January.
Aline Barros is VOA's immigration reporter. We caught up with her in Brazil. Aline, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this breaking story for us.
Thank you.
From border crossings in the U.S. to border crossings in the Middle East. In the past 2 months, more than 500,000 people have fled into Syria from Lebanon. Many of them were refugees who had previously fled the Syrian civil war. Those returning to Idlib, the last rebel stronghold in Syria, say they're escaping to a place that is only a little safer than Lebanon, without homes, jobs, or humanitarian aid waiting for them. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul with Mawaya Atrash in Idlib, Syria.
For years, Syrian civil defense volunteers, known as White Helmets, have been helping people escape bombings and other attacks in rebel-held Syria. Now, tens of thousands of escapees are coming back home to Syria. This time, they are fleeing the war in Lebanon, many after living as refugees for more than a decade. This is Nadal Dabdoub of the White Helmets.
Our teams are working to provide necessary first aid to sick people and those who have gotten ill because of the long distance they have traveled. We transfer some cases to the hospitals.
The road from Lebanon to Idlib, the last rebel stronghold in Syria, is long and dangerous, new arrivals say. Mohammed Al Youssef is a Syrian refugee returning from Lebanon.
The trip was fraught with difficulties and bad treatment. We had to sleep on the dirt and stay on the road for 4 days.
Families arriving back in Syria are finding their old homes destroyed and no available jobs or humanitarian aid. But they say they had no choice but to flee. Abu Istif recently returned to Syria after living as a refugee in Lebanon for 12 years.
There was a bombing near us. They bombed a missile warehouse that no one knew about at all. And they bombed a house near us as well.
14-year-old Hassan returned alone to live with his grandfather in Syria. He is the only one who survived bombings in Lebanon that killed 18 of his relatives. In Syria, Hassan needs medical treatment, but the family cannot afford it, his grandfather says. Local officials say northwestern Syria may seem safer than Lebanon, but between lack of humanitarian aid and battles between the government and its allies and the rebels, it is only marginally so. Tariq El Ali is a public relations officer at the Ministry of Development in Idlib, Syria.
The situation in northwest Syria is very difficult now, as there is almost no relief aid because most organizations have withdrawn from the area. There is also continuous bombing.
The United Nations says that since Israeli bombing in Lebanon intensified in late September, more than 500,000 people have fled to Syria, including both Syrian refugees and Lebanese people. With Muawiya Atrash in Idlib, Syria, Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Carrick. We'll be right back.